Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. This is episode 204 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. And we actually have somebody on today, John Kiefer, world famous author of Carb Night, Carb Backloading. And dude, you probably walk around about 204 pounds, right?
Yeah, actually, I think I'm at like 210 right now.
Okay. So yeah. we'll fake the episode number and pop it up so it matches your body.
Yeah, unfortunately, maybe you can just put it in later so that it comes up as episode 210.
Perfect. Okay, we'll do that.
So hey. Oh, but I'm getting back to 6% body fat. So if you subtract those, we're at 204.
There we go. We're talking like lean body mass or something like that. So perfect. Hey, before we totally jump in on this, my last show, I forgot to introduce our show sponsors. So let me hammer through that really quick. FrontDeskHQ.com. FrontDesk is your mobile-based solution for service-based businesses, dog walking, car washes, CrossFit gyms, yoga, Pilates, you name it. If you know, you extort people for money in some sort of service-based deal, then FrontDeskHQ is the place to go. You can schedule a demo with them super easy, and that will pretty much sell you on that product. Wellfoodco.com is your solution for grass-fed beef jerky, grass-fed whey protein, these really amazing almond cookies, just basically, you know, high-quality snacky type stuff. But check them out. We actually have some MRE, legit meal replacement type things coming out with Whole Food Company here pretty soon. We've got the Performance Menu, Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence. Go to performancemenu.com. There are two different subscription kind of categories, $30 a year, $100 a year. The $100 a year gives you all the access to the back issues, 15% off in the Catalyst Athletic store. And then finally, MasaMeats.com. Masa Meats is who I get my grass-fed meat from. They are based in Northern California, can ship throughout the United States. Lots of people make good meat, but Masa Meats is literally the best grass-fed meat I've ever had. So check out Masa Meats. If you missed any of that, you can go to robwolf.com, check out the podcast, and we have banners for all of that crap. Okay, dude.
Wow.
So, yeah, holy shit. Like some people, so we get these podcasts transcribed, and some people, they've pinged me, and they're like, you know, when you go on and on about your show sponsors and there's literally like 8 pages talking about the sponsors, it gets a little bit, you know, long in the tooth. So I'm trying to streamline that stuff. But we had Dr. Perlmutter on a couple of podcasts back. Very, very popular show. Got some people kind of whipped into a ketogenic frenzy, both good, bad, confused. And Kiefer pinged me not too long after that and was like, hey, man, I've got some stuff that I kind of wanted to talk about. And so, and before we press play on this, you mentioned this concept of keto adaptation. Let's talk a little bit about that and some of your observations on the keto adaptation story.
Yeah, it's, you know, to me, and this is what I was saying before, you know, before we started recording, it, you know, at its best, I really feel like it's just bad nomenclature. It is an attempt to bring into this, you know, some kind of related research and extend it to human performance. And I think it's, you know, very inaccurate.
Well, let's go through what the, you know, so like a good friend of mine, Peter Attia, has done some pretty remarkable documentation on himself and going through what he would call like a keto adapted protocol. He went from being pretty overweight, training 3 or 4 hours a day. Like he is a training machine. The guy spends more time in the pool than I do, like sleeping. So, you know, but he had some serious issues with being able to lean out despite his enormous work volume. Kind of started eating what I think most people would consider more paleo, you know, low glycemic load, but still not really concerned about macronutrient breakdown particularly. And he saw some body composition improvements with that. Then finally went ketogenic and initially saw what we would normally expect, some drop off in anaerobic performance. After a couple of weeks, he saw his aerobic performance get back up to and maybe even beyond where he had been previously, like where his lactate threshold would kick in, was actually extended. And then over the course of about 2 years of tinkering with this, he feels like he's back up to largely having both the aerobic and the anaerobic capacity that he had before. he does play around with like some you know, some super starch. He plays around with a little bit of post-workout carb repletion to get the muscle glycogen up and try to partition nutrients into the muscles so that we're not getting too much hepatic glycogen repletion that would potentially kick us out of ketosis. But would you say that's a fair shake of what the, you know, the bare bones of the keto adaptation kind of story is, or do you want to expand on that before we talk about maybe some of your gripes with that terminology?
Yeah, no, well, yeah, I think that's kind of an accurate description. You know, Peter Attia, I love his work. I unfortunately haven't had a chance to converse with him yet, because a lot of what he does is, you know, essentially principles of like carb backloading and, you know, carb night stuff that, you know, I've been playing around with for over a decade now, at least carb night. So a lot of those things are accurate. You know, where I have the problem is, you know, without the clear-cut studies, and there really aren't any, but you know, some of the best we have for keto adaptation, and the reason I have a problem with the name is it's not really keto adaptation. You know, Dr. DePasquale, I think, had one of the best phrases, and it was kind of the de facto phrase for a ketogenic diet for a long time, and it was fat adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, in my opinion, is incorrect, because when you think about the average person, whether or even performance athlete, it's not as if the default cycle for human metabolism is carbohydrates. I think you'd have a very, very hard time proving that. So really what we're doing is we're breaking the carbohydrate adaptation and we're getting more down to baseline. And when you get there, then you can start asking the interesting questions. So what is it that our muscles or our heart or, you know, particular muscular systems are using for their preferred energy source? And once we get there, then we can really start asking the interesting questions like, okay, how can we manipulate carbohydrates at what time during the day and what day to extend whatever type of performance it is, whether it's endurance performance or whether it's power production or whether it's strength endurance. So it's all just, you know, to me, the really big fundamental problem is nomenclature and what that means and what that leads people to believe. Because, you know, now people are like psychotic about, oh, I've got to be ketogenic all the time. I've got to be in ketosis. You know, it makes my muscles more efficient. If you look at the rat heart, you get, you know, 30% greater efficiency and all those things I think are very, very confusing to most people, because there's a ton of information that's left out that shows, you know, a lot of that stuff doesn't extend to your skeletal muscle tissue. You know, it's not equivalent.
And John, maybe something worth mentioning here is we could have a let's, you know, in quotations, like a carb-adapted athlete, and we give that individual some ketone esters, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so this person has never really trained in a ketotic state, but we could throw some ketone esters down this person, and they will preferentially utilize those ketones, and we get this benefit from the ketones without a specific adaptation period. And so I think that your point about this becoming more, upregulation of lipolytic enzymes and smart partitioning of and utilization of glycogen is really a well-made one, because we could, with just the application of just ketone esters alone or even just MCT oil, we could see a really significant uptick ketone body production, and then we get a mitigation of glucose being utilized by the brain. We get some nice benefits with heart musculature. It's going to be used and the diaphragm and all that stuff. So I think that that's actually a really good point. And as you were talking, it just occurred to me, it's like, okay, yeah, we could apply, say, like a ketone ester to somebody and see some immediate potential benefits, particularly on the longer time scale of physical activity.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that. You know, if you just kind of go backwards, you should be able to, like, that's a perfect experimental paradigm, because you should be able to say, okay, let's look at where are the enzymes most highly concentrated that use ketone for rapid energy production. And as far as muscle tissue goes, it's the heart and the diaphragm. Any muscle tissue that's made for sustained constant contraction. So, you know, the heart's constantly beating, the diaphragm's contracting and relaxing. Skeletal muscle tissue, it turns out, has very low concentrations of 3-hydroxybutyrate dehydrogenase, which is, you know, one of your main enzymatic pathways for ketone production. And it goes up when you are ketogenic for a long period of time. You have higher concentrations in the heart and diaphragm. And actually, your skeletal muscle tissue at that point will shut off ketone metabolization. It almost completely preserves ketones for heart, diaphragm, brain, nervous system tissue. So, you know, the experiment where you can give ketones and you get an immediate boost in endurance capacity really shows how it's that the heart and those tissues that need to run more consistently and can get a greater efficiency out of it that ultimately results in performance. And so, you know, it's nice you have that immediate effect you can see, and you also see that long term.
Nice. So, you know, so some of the, and this is maybe going a little bit tangential, but I, you know, up front, and then I'll probably try to wrap this up again because, oh man, people love to make this stuff a black and white thing. So we had Dr. Perlmutter on here. He's a top of the food chain neurologist, published in the journal Neurology at the age of like 19. Like I still think he had like, you know, amniotic fluid on the guy when he published. And so a really legitimately brilliant guy, has been both right at the top of the research scene and the clinical scene. And he is doing absolutely amazing work in neurodegenerative disease using ketogenic diets to treat this stuff. And, you know, we're looking at everything from Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, I think possibly even Huntington's disease that may benefit dramatically from this stuff. These are things that we have literally zero effective pharmacological intervention. Like, our pharmacology sucks in dealing with this stuff. It's incredibly expensive. If you throw into this traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress that we're seeing out of the military, and the benefits that a ketogenic diet could have with this, and I would actually argue potentially a cyclic ketogenic diet being maybe even better because of hormetic stress response, but that's still a ways to be seen. But anyway, there's a massive amount of morbidity and mortality with this. People are dying. People's quality of life are less. And we have this great guy who's gone out here and is really, like, blazing a path in some effective treatment protocols. And I think we need to celebrate that and hold this guy up and really rally around him. But we need to also understand that that is not the only way to skin the cat, or, you know, depending on what the situation is, that may be not the only thing that we do. At the end of my podcast with Dr. Perlmutter, I asked him, hey, you know, I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Should I still be doing my post-workout, you know, yam or sweet potato? And he's like, no, you're not keto adapted. You need to do more work with that, which I've just found a damnable time with glycolytic based activities to really get fueled that way. I need some sort of consistent carb intake, whether it's like a carb night or a carb backloading. And for me, actually, lately, it's like I've just been eating more carbs in general, and I've been doing really, really well with the jits. And so that's just been where my level is. But ironically, it's still not like high carb. It's like 250, maybe 300 grams on a training day, and about half that on a non-training day. But, you know, folks want to make kind of a one-size-fits-all story out of this, and I just can't emphasize enough that's probably not a good thing, that we need to understand what therapeutic interventions are. We need to understand, you know, individual traits, and I just wanted to get that out there early so that people keep it in mind, even though they're going to forget it and want to turn it into a religion anyway. Okay, sorry.
I was going to say that's perfect, because that's exactly what I say. You know, there's no one perfect diet for every single person, you know, but for every person, there's the perfect diet for the perfect time.
Right.
You know, depending on what they need. And I it's so interesting you bring up the ketones to use to treat Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. We have all these conditions, and that struck me for the first time. This is what got me on this whole, you know, tirade about talking about things appropriately and using the right titles, because, you know, a paper published recently is like, you know, degenerative diseases of which, you know, ketones are a novel therapy. And you can think about it that way. You know, you can think about when you put these people on a ketogenic diet and you start to see these remarkable improvements. Or if you flip the coin you could actually say carbohydrates as a potential source of neurodegenerative diseases.
Neurodegenerative toxicity, yeah.
Because you take that, you take carbs out of the system, you get a highly ketogenic diet, you know, one specifically that's high enough in fat for that continued ketone production, and you see all these huge benefits. And really the way that we should maybe be looking at it is, well, the carbs are poisoning us. You know, ketones aren't a novel treatment. We're just taking all the toxins out of the system, and lo and behold, things start to work well.
John, do you, you know, that that was one of the things, and I think that, you know, it's kind of one of the forest trees kind of things, like where I'm at with the carb toxicity story. Like, you know, we've got some examples like the Katavans, we've got some Okinawans. I still, you know, as I've evolved over this thing, I kind of lean in this direction of excessive calorie load, probably the carbohydrates being probably the big factor, you know, like neuroregulation of appetite. But this thing of looking at mitochondrial dysfunction, damage to the mitochondria, mm-hmm. and then we start getting problems from there in which we are not able to handle the carbs in and right. you know, relative to fat. What do you think about all that? Like that's kind of where I'm at. I've followed a lot of stuff from like Stefan Guyanet, Chris Masterjohn, Matt Lalonde has bludgeoned me, you know, pretty good with this stuff, because I definitely have been much more. You know, it's interesting because, again, when you see somebody very, very sick, and we use this therapeutic intervention like a ketogenic diet, low carb diet, or some sort of cyclic carb approach, and you see such enormous benefit, then I think it's easy to say, okay, the carbs were the causative factor. But can we completely, in an airtight fashion, say that's it? Or, you know, is it just that we're seeing a tremendous therapeutic benefit here, but, you know, as far as a mechanism of causation, we may still kind of have to go back to excessive calorie load, mitochondrial dysfunction because of that, carbs and refined carbs, refined food probably being hyperpalatable, and we're overeating that, and we're overwhelming the you know, mitochondrial substrates and whatnot. But where are you at on that story?
Well, for as far as mitochondrial health and everything, I've been on that bandwagon for some time, you know, kind of curious about what are all the potential avenues there, because Dr. Bruce Ames, who, you know, I've talked to, he studies tumorogenesis in children, and he's been studying that for like, you know, 60 years.
And all vegans should talk to Bruce Ames and we curl yes. their toes. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, his take was, and he came up with this, I think about 40 years ago, he started this, well, you know, all lifespan is really, you know, longevity for an organism is really heavily dependent on the health of its mitochondria. And, you know, he's been saying this forever, and it was really, you know, only recently we started to see that, yes, that's you can make a very strong case for that. And I think the problem was for most people to say, okay, well, then what's causing the mitochondrial damage? You know, I think Dr. Ames was way too simplistic. He said, if you take 7 vitamins and 7 minerals, your mitochondria are super healthy for life. Nothing else matters. Hmm. And I think that simplistic argument really worked against him to get people to look at that more seriously. But now we can see a lot of the other mechanisms. If you eat a lot of carbohydrates and you're in that glycolytic pathway more often, no matter, you know, what type of exercise or activity, you always have a higher lactate production, and you'll always have some calcium dysfunction within the mitochondria and the calcium sodium pumps that go on there, and you can actually start to cause a lot of damage. And so now we've elucidated all these mechanisms. So I think there's a very strong argument for mitochondrial health and the overall health of the organism. And I also think we're getting to the point that, you know, it's one more piece of the puzzle. We can say, yes, carbohydrate diets, if that is the predominant fuel source and you're not using those in an effective capacity, so I want to take exercise out of this, or the right type of exercise even, you know, I don't think endurance exercise you need carbs for. So if you have these carbs and you're using them in the wrong way, you are causing potential degradation of the mitochondria. So, you know, to me, you know, I just think it's, you know, with everything I've seen and all the research I've been looking through, it's just one more nail in the coffin of using carbohydrates inappropriately. And by that, I mean most of the American public should not be eating a lot of carbohydrates very often.
And, you know, is this in part because we're not sleeping enough, we're too sedentary, we've got too much stress, we've got gut dysbiosis, and so, you know, again, like people will look at like the Katavans, the Okinawans, like some people that eat a low toxicity diet, relative to like pulling gluten out of the diet and stuff like that. Right. But they seem to motor along pretty well on a reasonably high carbohydrate level, like anywhere from like 60 to 70% of total carbs, good longevity. But we also, you know, the refined element isn't there, refined seed oils, again, sleep, vitamin D, like all these extenuating factors. That's some of the stuff that I've been trying to wrap my head around is, you know, if these other factors are pretty well squared away, are we okay? You know, or is this just an across the board kind of thing? And that's something that's been hard for me to really pin down. Like my gut sense has been that a part of the reason why, say, like a westernized population might benefit from significant carbohydrate restriction is because we don't sleep enough. We have this wacky gut dysbiosis. We're being born by C-section and not vaginally, you know, all these different things that can lead into systemic inflammation, insulin resistance, and then we need to... It's almost like, you know, in the case of PKU, phenylketonuria, you have a genetic aberration that causes the individual to not metabolize phenylalanine. And so the phenylalanine accumulates in the body and can become toxic and kill the person. So we do a low phenylalanine diet. And so are we epigenetically tweaking people with, you know, low vitamin D, stress, bad sleep, et cetera, to make them carbohydrate intolerant? And that, you know, it becomes somewhat superfluous as to whether or not there's carbohydrate in the diet. We've already got the deck stacked against us because of these other factors, and some people are really going to need to limit carbs in the same way that people with PKU are going to need to limit phenylalanine. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, this is pretty much like preaching to the choir here.
Cool.
Yeah, because so except. You know, you're the first one to actually introduce this from the opposite direction that I would. And mine is that carbohydrates, you know, regardless, if you look at everything, you know, gut issues, overall health problems, sleeping problems, stress problems of our Western culture, my take on it is those are so devastating because of our diet. So our carbohydrate-based diet is actually causing us to have we're basically poisoning ourselves on a regular basis. You know, we've got this flood of carbohydrates, depending on which one, fructose, glucose, it's being metabolized differently in the liver, which could cause essentially low-grade liver dysfunction in how it's metabolizing things. We could get these end products that aren't utilized very well. The body's got to figure out how to dispose of all those. You know, we've got all this going on, and so my take is the carbohydrates are kind of already giving us this low-grade sickness. And then if you pile everything else on top of it, the body just can't handle it. And, you know, an interesting research with gut health and carbohydrates is they actually took celiac patients who had, you know, gone into total remission, and they gave them a carbohydrate and gluten load with a special enzyme that degraded all the carbohydrate before it can actually get to the intestinal tract. And what they found was the end result was the gliadin protein fractions were intact. All the carbohydrate had been basically destroyed, and the celiac patients had no inflammatory reaction whatsoever. So in that case, it almost looks like carbohydrates are a necessary trigger to get some sort of complication out of, you know, whatever it is that might be that you might have a major allergy to right now. Really, the lighter fluid on that could be the carbohydrates. It's really that the body, you know, can handle certain things. And like you said, you've got the hormetic response of stress, and there's probably a hormetic response to toxins that we get in the environment that actually help the body to evolve at one point. You know, you got poisoned a little bit every once in a while. The body learned how to handle it, how to adapt to it, made it more robust. But now we're just constantly poisoning ourselves, and the body can't recover. So from my perspective, it's the carbohydrates that are causing the systemic poisoning where the body can't handle all the other stressors. And you make a very compelling argument for the opposite point of view, which is, well, it's everything else that's causing this low-grade poisoning to the system to where it can no longer handle carbohydrates. And I think whatever perspective you come from, right now it would be hard to come up with any other argument for the Western population other than we really need to limit carbohydrates in the diet. Because until we do that, we can't answer those fundamental questions.
Well, and you have a ton of people, police, fire, military, medical, who, you know, they are not going to be able to address their sleep. They're going to remain on shift work. We might be able to get their vitamin D up. We might give them an iPhone-based app where they can, you know, meditate 5 minutes a day and mitigate their stress a little bit. But the dietary intervention is really the thing that the people have the most control over, and particularly in these really impacted populations, and also, you know, anybody with new kids or something like that. Like, if you're in a situation where you're just not going to be able to control your sleep environment. And this is one of the things that I've seen a almost cyclical battle on this thing is, I guess because that's so much of the time that I spend is with police, military, and fire, you know, working with the risk assessment and all that. And we see these people that are really metabolically broken, low androgen levels, low vitamin D levels. They've got all these other cards stacked against them. And it's like, okay, man, the one thing that we can do, you know, is we can lower your carbohydrate load, get some better fats, get some better protein in there, mitigate the toxin load into your gut, maybe get you eating some fermented foods. And like, we can do that, but I can't get you off shift work. Like, we can slowly start ramping up your vitamin D, but this other stuff, unless they're just going to shift career. But then all that does, and I think towards the end of the podcast, we'll talk a little bit more about how Kiefer is maybe shifting gears a little bit from performance orientation to more health and longevity orientation in the folks that he works with. But, you know, okay, so we move that one person out of that spot, but then who else is going to step into the spot of being on night shift with the local police force? You know, I mean, somebody else is going to do it, and that's going to impact them, and it's going to impact society at large at some point. So,
yeah, it was interesting. There's a few fire departments in and around Phoenix that are using Carbnite with some of the firefighters. So I got to go on ride-alongs with them and see what their day was like. And, you know, it's interesting. They don't have that many calls that would be amazingly stressful, like, you know, major five-alarm fires or anything. But, you know, just that broken cycle, it's like, you know, in at least around Phoenix, you know, they're basically EMT/fire. So somebody calls up and, you know, they feel like they're having a heart problem and really all they want is somebody to take them to the doctor to get their medication. You know, they're up in the middle of the night going on a call, and it just is so rampant. And, you know, exactly what you said, you know, they wanted to try something because they just felt like they were overweight and out of shape.
Right.
Which is what got them on it. But like you said, there's two environments that your body exists between. That's the external environment, you know, the world around you, and the internal environment, which is all the food and bacteria that you're accidentally putting in your, all that stuff that you have absolute control over. So if you can only control one of those environments, you know, it makes sense you're going to try to, you want to hone in on the one that you can just fine tune as much as possible to try to handle the world around you. Whereas, you know, in the past, maybe during evolution, that wasn't the case. You know, we had to adapt a different way. But now, you know, we have the ability to kind of, you know, within reason, fine-tune our internal environment to match our external environment. Whereas, you know, back in the day, we probably had to move somewhere else so that we could fine-tune our external environment to match what we could get into our internal environment.
And you know, I think that, you know, this can get into some just so stories, you know, talking about cavemen and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think it is intriguing that, you know, when you look at some of the basic anthropology about like the work week of a hunter gatherer and even just critters at large living in the environment, the sun goes down, they go down, or unless they're nocturnal, then they get up. And, you know, those are some kind of embedded elements that are just kind of part and parcel with our physiology. And it's clear, whether we're talking human, animal, or other animals, that you know, each one of those factors that we tweak from, you know, photo period to changes in diet, changes in activity level, changes in socialization, each one of those kind of counts as a potential stress. And it's this cumulative effect that then we need to start figuring out, okay, how are we going to deal with this? I just had my friend John Durant on the show this last go around, and he wrote a book, The Paleo Manifesto. And in the beginning of the book, he used this example of this guy from the, I want to say the Boston Zoo, maybe it's the New York Zoo, but he tells a story about this guy who was eating like fiber bars eating a low-fat diet, you know, all this stuff, should be healthy, but was having neurological conditions, was picking his hair out and all this stuff, and it ended up being like a gorilla. And the way that they fixed the gorilla was starting to feed the gorilla like lettuce and celery, and they put him into a more naturalistic environment. And so instead of a concrete floor, it was dirt floor and a way bigger enclosure and more critters to play around with and everything. And lo and behold, feeding him, changing the photo period so that it cycled more with the seasons instead of it just being a really static element, a bunch of the health problems went away. The GI problems went away. The clear kind of psychological distress that this gorilla was under seemed to go away. Quick picking his hair out and all that stuff, you know, these kind of OCD type behaviors. So I think, again, you know, if we lived on a desert island and we went to bed when the sun went down and we got up when the sun came up and we had low stress, but the only thing that we had to eat were wheat thins, the likelihood of the wheat thins, you know, completely eviscerating us are probably a lot less than if you are a night shift cop who's got three kids at home and you're under financial stress and, you know, and then you're dealing with a bunch of thugs all the time. And you know, the firefighters, I would say in a lot of ways, almost have it worse. Like here in Reno, I want to say in a 48-hour shift, it is not uncommon for these folks to go on 35 calls in a 48-hour shift. So, I mean, they are just go the whole time. Yeah. And when they finally do lay down and get a little bit of rack time, they're literally, you know, they get 5 minutes, 10 minutes of rack time, and then boom, they're off and running again.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, unfortunately, you've made a compelling argument for the other direction. So I'm going to have to. No, I've been like so, you know, hardcore on just because we've got all this great science behind carbohydrates and how they can screw up metabolism. You know, it's probably my own internal prejudice at this point that's just pointing everything towards carbohydrates. It's like, let's get that fixed. And then we can figure out, you know, what's the next big one that needs to be fixed. And, you know, like you said, in some populations, there's just the big one is something we can't fix.
Right.
You know, you really can't do anything about their sleep cycle. It's just the nature of their job.
Right. And you know, I think you make a great point, which is that I think that we could legitimately step back and say, okay, we're not 100% sure whether this is coming from, you know, whether it's the baseball bat to the back of the head or the front of the head that's the worst problem, you know.
Right.
But the fact that we're getting hit in the head with a baseball bat from both directions, there's a problem here. And so what do we do to address that? And I think that's sometimes where people will lose their minds with me is that, you know, I'll advocate a higher carb intake for like MMA fighters and stuff like that. But then I'll turn right around. And you know, if we've got a firefighter that, again, is, you know, doing 35 calls in a 48-hour period and has all kinds of other life stress, they maybe shouldn't be eating a low carb diet or a high carb diet all the time. But then I'll flip that right back around and say maybe they shouldn't be ketogenic every day all the time too, because of cortisol issues and thyroid dysregulation and stuff like that. And so we need to think about, you know, what's their strength and conditioning look like? Does this person need to be doing, do they need to be training for the CrossFit games? Or should they lift some weights and do some, you know, more moderate intervals and partition carbs post-workout? Or, you know, maybe the way that you recommend in a carb backloading kind of format, so that we're getting some advantage on our non-insulin mediated glucose transport and stuff, but we're still getting that insulin pulse, we're not overwhelming the system, you know, we're getting a hormetic stress response, but it, you know, we're flying under the radar of what's going to become an insurmountable stress that's already being added to a stressful environment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And, you know, you go to these other populations like, you know, Okinawa, and I just wanted to come back to that because, you know, the interesting thing to me and what I haven't seen a lot of is, you know, I know they're healthy and I know they peter along for a long time, and they've got a very low toxicity diet. You know, white rice is one of the lowest toxicity natural foods that you can find. And,
well, and they do a ton of sweet potatoes, which yes. even in the literature on them, they've done some interesting stuff indicating mm-hmm. that as they shifted away from the more traditional sweet potato-based diet to a white rice-based diet, they show health problems. It's pretty interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, my curiosity there is, like, what is the genetic factor?
Right.
You know, we can look at I was just reading this in, I think it was Scientific American, maybe. It was a really interesting research done recently on one of the genetic markers for, you know, the function of our immune system. And unfortunately, I can't recall it all right now. But, you know, there's basically in humans, there's four different types, subtypes. And they found that in ancient mummies, the ones that had what they assume is the most ancient subtype, even in the northern populations where they ate primarily, you know, meat and fat, they saw signs of atherosclerosis, which really surprised them. So then they went back and they tried to look at correlate these four different mutations with longevity. And it turns out if you have that, the oldest allele, that you are going to die 6 years earlier than everybody else. So there's like a huge genetic factor that is way outside of what most people consider looking at for just longevity and health. So, you know, the question is in that Okinawan population, what are the defining characteristics that we haven't identified yet? Is it purely diet?
Right.
You know, it could well be. Is it lifestyle? Is it some adaptation quality that they've had from being on that same diet for so long? And, you know, we ignore all these things. That's why I hate it when somebody says, oh, well, obviously low-carb diets aren't healthy and that's not the answer because look at Okinawa. That to me just doesn't even make sense. You know, we have such variety across human populations where, you know, you get one group, you put them on an extremely low-carb diet and, you know, their LDL cholesterol like goes through the roof. It's like, well, does that even matter? And there's obviously some genetic trigger there causing it that we haven't identified. But, you know, at the same time, we've been looking at so many of the wrong parameters for so long. It's caused this unbelievable confusion amongst health professionals and amongst the nutrition community and the performance community. It's still struggling with the idea that calories in, calories out might not be right. And here you are, you know, talking about some of these advanced concepts, and they're like, oh, you know, they're the most vocal on the web. Which unfortunately just, you know, confuses more and more people. And it's this context that is really missing in the dialogue that's out there that's, I think, preventing us from moving forward. You know, for example, the idea of keto adaptation. To me, if you're keto adapted, that means your muscle mass is no longer using ketones. And they've shown that within 2 to 3 weeks of being ketone adapted, your skeletal muscle tissue no longer uses ketones, almost exclusively fatty acids. So you've already kind of muddied your main concept with this keto adaptation for performance when really what you're saying is, well, no, we've made the body fat adapted and we've actually limited ketone use in skeletal muscle tissue. So what did we do? Are we keto adapted or are we a high fat diet adapted? And, you know, little inconsistencies like that turn into huge snowballs that really to the layperson hurts. You know, it really hurts the credibility of anybody who's become too locked into a definition without explaining the full ramifications of that definition. Keto adapted, if you want to say keto adapted is possibly one of the ideal paradigms for, let's say, health and endurance training. And here's why. You get higher stroke volume per unit energy in the heart. You get greater efficiency in your diaphragm. You get greater efficiency in neural capacity and neuron firing. But at the same time, you're not using ketones whatsoever in your skeletal muscle tissue. You're relying on fatty acids and you will go glycolytic and you've got to have some glycogen stores for that. You know, if you fully explain that, then I think you close the doors to some of the arguments that really hurt any one perspective too much. You know, paleo, the defining characteristic of paleo is definitely no longer this is how Paleolithic man ate.
Right.
You know, it's an unfortunate legacy of the name, but the concept is, okay, you're sick. There's something that you're putting into your diet that's poisoning you. Let's find out that what that is, and we'll take that out. And then maybe we'll get you back to a point of health where those things won't matter as much. And, you know, Jim Laird's my favorite example on that because the guy was terrified of gluten, which he should have been from what he went through. And I finally talked to him when he was out at Paleo FX last time. I was like, Jim, you are so healthy. I will bet you anything that you can eat a box of cherry turnovers and you'll be fine. And he goes, no, man, I can't do it. I can't do it. I know how allergic I am. And I was like, I'm just saying, I think you were so sick that is why you had such massive reaction. I'm not saying you can eat cherry turnovers every day, but I bet if you did it once, you wouldn't notice anything. And he finally broke down and had a box of cherry turnovers, and he texts me the next day. He's like, dude, I haven't felt this good in, you know, weeks. I had an amazing workout, no problems. And of course, he didn't eat cherry turnovers again for several months, and I don't know if he has. But, you know, it kind of just proves the point. We're so sick that, you know, for different people, there's really different avenues of attack. And I think, you know, the paleo name has caused some backlash against it, unfortunately, because of the name and what it implies. But it's really, at its core, no matter what, a very, very sound principle of getting somebody healthy. End of story.
Right. Right. Using that framework. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the gluten issue, like I would say that if I ate a box of cherry turnovers, I would probably decommission every bathroom in the house. but I will say this, that if I've been sleeping well, if my training's been good but not over the top, mm-hmm. you know, I'm waking up and I've got an erection in the morning, so clearly my testosterone is good and all that sort of stuff. If I go out to eat and, you know, like I'll get a little gluten dose inadvertently because I really don't play with those waters at all. But I'll go out and I'll be like, oh, I got a little dose. It won't be bad in the morning. I'll be fine. Like I'll have a little something. But if I've been on the road for a week, time zone changes, you know, all the stuff going on, bad stress, bad sleep. And then it's almost like if I in breathing the air, then I get a gluten dose, you know, and like right. my guts are destroyed for 3 or 4 or 5 days. And I know even for myself, and I'm probably like one of these canary in the coal mine types that like, I'm going to be the first one to die from whatever it is. It's, right. it's going to, you know, in toxicology, there's this term LD50. It's, you know, you take a toxicant, expose it to a population of animals. And then when 50% of them have died, then you call it the LD50. I would be the first one to die, you know. But, you know, I've noticed in myself that my ability to, you know, my anti-fragility, my robustity, whatever you want to call it, if I'm taking care of all these other lifestyle features, then I notice that that I'm a little more robust on the diet. And then the other side of that is that if I'm pretty solid on the diet, then I'm a little more robust on the mm-hmm. lifestyle piece. If I miss some sleep, if I'm training really, really hard, I've been doing 4 or 5 days a week of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, a couple of days a week of weights, and at 41 years old, like I'm motoring along with that. I have to listen to my body, and if I'm beat up, then I take a day off or I do a recovery day or something like that. But, you know, it goes pretty well. But if I start making inroads in the sleep and the food, and mm-hmm. I'm not taking my vitamin D and stuff like that, then I definitely see like the wheels start falling off the wagon.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's really a matter of how many stressors have you piled on, and at what point can your body no longer handle it? And that's the problem with some of the quote unquote young experts we have that are, you know, in their early 20s and they're running around the internet, like, why do this? And I do this. Like, man, when I was 20 years old, I did stuff that would kill me today.
Right. Right.
You know, there's no way I could go in and start doing 3-hour workouts again and sleep 3 or 4 hours a night and go teach all the next day and have to deal with students that I hated and then go take my tests. And then, you know, go back to the gym and repeat. You know, there's no way I could do that right now. You know, and what I wish I would have understood back then was that, you know, had I decreased the stressors in my life, I probably would have gotten much better results all the way around the board. You know, right. I would have gotten better training results. I would have gotten better personal results. I would have gotten better academic results. So, you know, it's just this, unfortunately, you don't understand how fragile your body is until you've actually caused so many problems that it's hard to fix.
Right. What do they say? Youth is wasted on the young.
Yes.
Yeah. If I knew in my 20s what I know now, I could have been something. I could have been a contender.
Right. Exactly.
Or I would have just been incredibly average, like I already am. But so man, you've done a lot of work with some high end athletes, particularly in the physique and powerlifting scene. But you know, to that point, you've had a ton of success. You have some very high-level people, very credible people that sing your praises about the technology that you've used on stuff, carb night, carb backloading, and being able to tweak and modify things to help folks. But you've been feeling a bit of a different calling. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, actually, you know, oddly enough, it's not really like when I wrote Carb Night back in 2004, got it out in 2005. Like really my main goal of that book, and you can see it if you read the book, you know, I'm really speaking to the average person.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had so many friends, you know, in the performance community, I'd gotten to the point where I felt like it was, you know, kind of easy because you're working out so much, you can make a lot of mistakes and still look pretty good and be pretty healthy. But, you know, I had a lot of friends who were older and, you know, family members and friends my age who were starting to see, you know, the problems that most people have, they're gaining fat and all this. And I really wrote Carb Night as a simplified version of what I used performance-wise to just help people lose body fat. And at the time, you know, my limited knowledge was that if you do everything to reduce body fat and save muscle mass, you're just going to be healthier. You know, end of story. And then we can start looking at all this other stuff later. And Carb Night just didn't take off. You know, I was really naive. It's like one of those, if you build it, they will come. Well, nobody came. And, you know, that went on for 5 or 6 years. And then I decided to make another go of it. And oddly enough, where I found that I could get a lot of traction was in the performance community, because those people will do anything to get that next 2% of performance out of themselves.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of this, it drove it backwards. You know, I got into the performance community and then, you know, people kind of stumbled on Carb Night because I wasn't really talking about it very much. So they went from carb backloading to Carb Night. And then, you know, their friends started seeing results in the gyms, the ones who were on the treadmill all the time. So then it kind of leaked into the lay population, and Carb Night actually now, as far as, you know, sales and volume, is way outpacing carb backloading. And there's been this just big shift. I get a lot more questions about, well, is this good for diabetics? Is this healthy for this? Is this what's going to happen with my cholesterol levels? And then Dr. Rocky Patel has made like a really big push because, you know, he was just sold on Carb Night. He used it on himself for a couple years and did the carotid artery scan. And before Carb Night, you know, his carotid artery age was, you know, almost 50 or almost older, and, you know, he's in his early 40s. And then after Carb Night, his carotid artery scan went back down to that of a 20-year-old.
What's interesting, though, is that his LDL particle count went up.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was talking about earlier. So, you know, he was like, okay, and that really changed his perception of all this stuff we're looking at, and is it the wrong stuff? And so he's been using Carb Night a lot with very metabolically deranged people. He was, you know, I was in Phoenix last weekend, and we sat down to dinner. He's talking to me about somebody who came in and they're, you know, 450 pounds. They started paleo actually and got down to 380 and stalled, and their blood work looks pretty good. And they were, you know, complaining about stalling. And he, you know, brought him in and said, here's what I want you to do. Broccoli, beef, butter for the next 2 weeks, and then you're going to eat some carbs. You know, and this guy came in and his blood works even better now, you know, after just 2 weeks of, you know, kind of using that paradigm. So that's really where I want to make the major push, because, you know, I'm looking at it from my perspective. My perspective at this point is, you know, I'm healthy, I'm still young, I'm still very productive, and there's all these people in the United States who are getting incredibly sick, they're getting incredibly ill, And it's not all their fault. They're getting like very bad advice. The food that's available to them, it's very low quality, and it's exacerbating this problem. And you know, eventually, I'm going to be taking care of them financially, because you know, our industry as a whole and our government as a whole has made them very sick. And I would rather them have a more enjoyable, productive life, because it takes the burden off of everybody, and you know, it prevents the United States from becoming insolvent in healthcare bills. You know, I remember just the feeling of being in a society where people are healthy weight and they feel good is so extremely different. When I was in Vienna, it's just such a different atmosphere anywhere you go. And the population there is the complete reverse of us. If you saw somebody who was obese or overweight, they spoke English.
Right.
Whether it was British English or American English, they spoke English.
Right.
And, you know, just that buzz you get from that feeling of people who feel good and are still productive in life and still, you know they've got a long life ahead of them to think about, even though they're in their 40s or 50s, it's just such a different paradigm. And it's something that I would like to see in this country again.
Yeah, it's always fascinating traveling abroad and seeing usually people think I'm a Canadian, you know, if I'm not talking like Canadian or Australian or something like that, because I'm not fat. And so it's kind of interesting. Well, you know, it's clearly like a big chunk of my focus has been on this, you know, the healthcare scene, you know, and I guess, you know, my gig has been all along, and it really seems like you've thrown this out there in the same way that, you know, just trying to get this idea out there that there might be a different way to do things. Like if you want to drive the car, you know, at 100 miles an hour into the brick wall, cool. I would prefer not to pay for that. I would like to be in a different insurance tranche than those people. But, you know, in my kind of libertarian leanings, I'm kind of cool with that. But it's going to be an interesting couple of, you know, 5 to 10 years to see how, you know, like in the States, how the Affordable Care Act rolls out, how the economy goes. Can we continue to pay for the third party system the way it is? Can we continue to subsidize a broken food system the way that we've been doing? Like, lot of the, and I know people get pissed at me when I bring in some of the politics stuff. People are really excited when we beat up on Monsanto or something. But when you start using these same kind of market analysis type things, talking about healthcare and things like that, they kind of get kind of pissed off about it. But you know what? A lot of our problems are we subsidize the production of cheap, bad food. And whether you know, you go into you know, we simply overeat calories or we simply overeat carbohydrate. At the end of the day, the reason why we overeat is because we have hyperpalatable food of some variety, you know, and the bulk of it is government subsidized. And then, you know, we're paying for that on the front end, and then we pay for it on the back end when people are sick and unproductive and miss time at work and all the rest of that. But it's intriguing to me. Like, I'm not sure how or if that system can really keep limping along. Like, at some point, it seems like there's going to be some sort of reckoning with that. So I'm very intrigued to see how all that plays out.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the politics of it, because everybody always focuses on the resulting problem that came out of the politics of it. You know, people, if you were to actually describe what Nixon did with our food supply as a communist push for the food supply system, everybody would be up in arms. Like, oh my gosh, that's horrible. But, you know, the way it's pitched is it's subsidized so that Americans can have cheap, affordable food. But, you know, and so the end result of that is like high fructose corn syrup being used heavily in our industry. And the question is it the high fructose corn syrup that's a problem, or was it the subsidies that made corn a really appealing substrate to then metabolize into a substitute for sugarcane? Because that's really what it is. It's hard to make sucrose out of just a pure glucose syrup, but it's really easy to make high fructose corn syrup. And if you look at the trend ever since the corn supply in particular was subsidized, it's the amount of carbohydrate in the diet that's really skyrocketed, whether it's through high fructose corn syrup or what have you. And that's because the price of carbohydrates have deflated significantly over the last 30, 40 years. So it's really the cheapest food that you can possibly get for your family. And you know, with a larger divide between the haves and have-nots, the cheaper food is obviously going to be more appealing if you got two or three kids at home. And, you know, even fast food. Fast food is subsidized by the corn because, like you said, you know, the cattle are all farm-raised and they're all being fed off of corn. So if you deflate the price of corn, you've deflated the price of beef for the next 30 years as well. And, you know, it just all kind of compounds on each other. And it's – you trace it back and you think, well, you know, one small change really had this huge ripple effect and nobody's looking at that small change anymore. And like you said, is it sustainable? And I don't think it is. I think if we went back to a competitive market that we would see an increase in food prices, but in the more refined stuff that is now hyper palatable, cheap, you know, easy to prepare, those things are what would get inflated in price. Sodas, we wouldn't see it amongst the natural foods.
Yeah, and you know, it again, it's just kind of funny because people, whether the, this may be the last podcast I end up doing because everybody will get pissed off because it's gone into political land, but, you know, whether you're on the right-leaning side of things, I noticed that there's certain kind of, you know, maybe religious right kind of leaning things that I would stick in the kind of social engineering category. I would definitely stick the same thing on in the liberal left category, but they're become these, you know, political talking points that are just near and dear and people want to talk about them and everything. And usually what it ends up boiling down to is trying to socially engineer behavior in people. And we're either going to guilt them or tax them or, you know, whatever the case may be. But then if we inject this moral hazard kind of situation in which, you know, so we in a hidden way, in a hidden cost, we make food cheap. It's really not cheap. We're sticking a bunch of tax money into it, you know, so it is really not cheap, but, it looks like it's not. But that's really the problem. Like, we're not going to socially engineer that problem out. Like, these foods are delicious, and, you know, the only way that you change that is, you let the market dictate how much of that really legitimately should be produced. And if people want to spend more money on that, then they're going to have to. But then the interesting thing is possibly the solution, instead of really looking at the healthcare side of this, is maybe at the food production side. But that it just, it rubs people the wrong way to suggest that stuff. And again, this may in fact be the last episode 204 may be the last podcast because it really will be like, fuck you guys, you're assholes, I'm done. So, you know, whatever. But it you know, I would just clearly, Kiefer, you've done some similar reading on this stuff and some similar type of analysis. I would just encourage people to do a little bit of reading about the history of our food production, like when Nixon changed our, you know, intensified food production and started the subsidy system and stuff like that. Interestingly, it was right on the heels of also liquidating the gold window, but that's a whole other podcast. That's an entirely different podcast. We won't get into that, but I would just encourage people, like, whatever your views on this, like, if you think I'm full of shit, think we're both full of shit on this stuff, just take a look at it and see. Like, I would love to be proven wrong on this and find some other solution in it, but I just haven't yet. I haven't found too many convincing side arguments. So, So dude, what, before we wrap up, what else do you have cooking? Where can folks find you? What else do you have cooking? What's going to be on the horizon here?
That's funny. I've been lying really low lately. I don't think I've put anything out. I've been on a couple podcasts, but that's been about it for... gosh, I think the last 6 months. As a lot of people know, dangerouslyhardcore.com got wrangled from me in somewhat of a seedy backstory there. And that, you know, after that kind of got taken, I just wasn't sure what the next incarnation was. And, you know, I think I've got that pinned down. The new website is officially not announced yet, but it'll be up soon. CBL2, I'm actually traveling to Boston for a couple weeks for total isolation, and then CBL2 will be done at the end of that, which is such a major revision. I mean, it's basically going to be a handbook for human metabolism starting at the mitochondria up.
Nice.
Because one of the failings I really think of carb backloading was, and carbonate even in some respects, was, you know, I was unleashing some very technical information on people that didn't have the appropriate background. So people just really couldn't understand some of the points, and it's caused this, you know, crazy set of critiques out there that have gotten people confused. And really all I want to do is eliminate that confusion and say, okay, these are the foundations upon which the body works, and these are the key points that I tried to utilize when creating this, and these have been the results. So I'm really excited about that. I just think it's going to be a great product.
So you're saying that if you understand how things work, then you can make some informed decisions about how to implement it? Is that really what you're saying?
I know that's the craziest concept, you know, ever to be elucidated. But yes, that's what I'm saying.
Dude, you can learn all you need in a 2-day strength and conditioning deal and about a 35-minute certification that talks about the zone and your right. money. That's all you need. Right. You need nothing else. It's crazy talk.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
dude, it was great having you back on the show. When you were first on the show, it was and still is one of the most popular shows that we've had. And I threatened that we would get back on here. And I'm stoked that you actually pinged me after the Dr. Perlmutter podcast, which also was a very, very popular show. Clearly, you know, it's fascinating to me. You know, there's clearly there's more story here about this carbohydrate. You know, the role of carbohydrate in human disease, human wellness, human performance. There's more to this story than I think that we, you know, what is easily spat out. You know, you can't, you know, throw too many 100% hard fast rules out there. Like even Kiefer is trying to make me rethink, you know, my thought that gluten is Satan's excrement, and you know, you should avoid it like a depleted uranium. So I'm gonna have to give some thought about that. But you know, I think it's one of these things that clearly we're seeing this intersection where we see some therapeutic interventions, we see some potentiality for optimizing human performance, and I think it's just, you know, worthwhile for folks to be chill and to read some research, and you know, possibly most important, listen to what people are saying, but then get in and experiment and run some blood work and track your own performance metrics. And that's going to be the most salient point out of this. Cause I've been using this, LD50 example from toxicology, you know, something that's a toxic dose for the first 50 animals, there's still 50 of the animals that are alive. Why are they alive? And the other ones are dead. And who are you, you know, and then when we're talking about that, whether we're talking about carbohydrate intake or alcohol intake or your tolerance for syphilis-infected hookers or whatever it is, you know, are you the one that's going to be the strong, hardy survivor, or are you going to be like me and be the canary in the coal mine and the first one to die?
Right.
And that's a really big question, and nobody is really going to know that except you and your ability to individually tinker and experiment. And again, you know, like you were talking about with your carb backloading too, if people understand some basic mechanisms, you've got some basic framework to make like a logic chart. You know, it's like, well, if I do this and this happens, then it will call that good or bad, you know, right. And then we'll kind of move forward from there. And generally, if you look, feel and perform better, if some biomarkers of health and disease go in a generally favorable direction, then that's good. But then, you bring up a great point with Rocky that, you know, I'm hanging a lot on that LDLP particle as being a significant problem, but yet we have with Rocky, we have a reversal of a carotid artery scan, which is really the indication, like, do we have atherogenic activity in the artery, yes or no? He did before, his LDLP went up, and now we don't later. Right. So what does that mean? Like, that's a whole, and again, does that apply to everybody? I don't know, but where I think being, you know, it's funny, 5 years ago, I would have been much more confident in knowing what a bunch of these answers are. And now I'm way, way less confident. So,
well, you know, if you think about it, we've had up until really recently, the last 10 or 15 years, we've had two paradigms. We've had high carbohydrate or we've had high fat. And only recently have any type of health practitioners started to kind of take this idea of ketogenic cycling seriously. And now you have just opened up a floodgate of questions. I mean, we don't have anything to base any of that stuff off of. And, you know, I think that's why people still like their hard lines like keto adapted or carb adapted, because, you know, for those, we do have some clear-cut information about endurance. But when you look at, like I said, power sports, strength sports, or, you know, even interestingly, diseased cases like glycogen storage disease, mm-hmm. we can very quickly see that carbohydrates are absolutely necessary for some things. If you've got somebody who's really only concerned with endurance and their endurance is up, and they say, well, I think my anaerobic capacity is up as well. Well, are you talking to somebody who weighs 200 pounds and benches 400 pounds?
Right.
Probably not. And could I have ever hit those levels with carbohydrates? I seriously doubt it. You know, I tried while on carb night and I failed miserably, and that's what led to carb backloading, and, you know, I did it. So, you know, there's a lot of things there that you just absolutely cannot be in a single mindset. It's like, this is it. You know, there was somebody on another podcast, and their question was, you know, I'm a strongman competitor and I'm really trying to be keto adapted, so I'm not eating carbs anymore. It's like, why? And it was basically because they'd, you know, been reading about Dr. Atiyah and the advantages of being keto adapted. And I'm like, that's not appropriate context for you.
Right.
You've got to think about the context. So, and you know, it just kills me. There's so much research out there. It's like, okay, a couple fundamental things you can answer clearly. And then there's tons of gray area, I admit, between, but you know, for maximum strength performance or hypertrophy or power production, you need carbohydrates. You at least need glycogen stores to be at a level that they can be tapped into. And for, you know, interesting study, and I'm running over in time. Is that okay?
Oh, totally, dude. Totally.
Yeah. You know, some of the pivotal, you know, one pivotal study, I think, is by Finney, where he took some obese people, and this research is cited by Dr. Atiyah as well. It's really interesting because he took some obese people, put them on a high ketogenic diet, but beforehand he depleted their muscle glycogen stores to 50% of normal. And then for, I think it was a six-week intervention, very, very low carbohydrate, they lost like 20 pounds, and then he had them, then he checked their muscle glycogen levels, and it had actually risen to 68% of what it had been from depletion. So even without any carbohydrates in the diet, the body sees glycogen stores as compelling enough to replenish with, and my guess is in that scenario, it came from the glycerol, that the glycerol flux that came out, you know, three chain right. carbon elements are great for resynthesizing muscle glycogen. So the body was, you know, willing to use that to recompensate glycogen stores. But then the problem is, and the interpretation of the research is, they did the same exercise, which was just hiking. So we're not talking about really glycolytic exercise. They were just hiking, and at the end of the hike, their glycogen level stores were still 68%. And so people are like, oh, see, you don't need carbohydrates at all for exercise. It's like totally the wrong paradigm.
Right.
If you'd put those guys on a bodybuilding circuit, you know, even if it was an appropriate one that wasn't too much volume, I guarantee that their muscle glycogen stores would not have stayed at 68%.
Right.
But, you know, people read those studies and they're just, you know, they're fabulous studies. It's a wealth of information that helps corroborate all kinds of other things. But at the same time, it's just the wrong context for someone like a strongman competitor.
Right. Well, you know, one other thought with that is that for every study we do, and this is the Robert Piercig, you know, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance gig, every study you do, it raises more questions. Like,
yeah.
it doesn't, you know, it occasionally you might kind of, you know, paint in a corner and you're like, okay, we have a pretty good understanding of this. But even within that story, you know, for ages, we thought that lactate was only recycled in the liver via the Cori cycle. It really wasn't utilized as a substrate. And then lo and behold, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, 9 years ago, it was like, oh, wait, stop the presses. Lactate is actually consumed directly in the mitochondria.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, right. We had 50, 60 years of biochemistry and physiology textbooks that said exactly the opposite. And it kind of, you know, on an intuitive level, it just kind of made sense. It's like, are you 100% sure that this stuff isn't utilized as a fuel substrate somewhere,
right.
somehow, you know? And so even things like that, you know, I mean, I still have some biochem textbooks that say emphatically that, you know, lactate is only reutilized via the Cori cycle, you know, glycogen resynthesis and whatnot, and it's not used as a primary substrate. And we were just wrong. We were just flat wrong on it. So, yeah.
See, that's where you have to be very careful about using, you know, those universals, because I read Dr. Richard Feynman, who, not the physicist, he does a lot of work in biological thermodynamics.
Right.
You know, he just wrote this great paper on fructose in perspective. And he makes the statement, you know, nowhere in the body do we actually have fructoneogenesis. And it turns out he's wrong. In the lens of the eye, we actually have enzymes that allow us to make fructose, and that contributes to cataracts and in diabetics. And then when we talk about the anaerobic, you know, resource, we're like, okay, you know, glucose primary, we don't have a lot of other substrates that we ingest, but it turns out that in hair follicles, they have an enzymatic pathway that hasn't been explored anywhere else that are glutaminolytic. Huh. You can actually burn glutamine in the absence of oxygen and produce ATP. So, you know, there's all these little things, and, you know, we just get little glimpses of them somewhere. And it's like, okay, well, now we've got to go through and reanalyze all the tissues of the body to see where else could this possibly be happening. So those universals are just, they'll get you every time.
Right, right. Well, in Dr. Perlmutter's book, too, he also mentioned that astrocytes have a limited capacity for ketogenesis and you know, what's the implication with that. But yeah, but we could get pretty geeky on that stuff all day long in between right. The politics and us going full ridiculousness on that. But cool, dude. Well, I am super stoked you reached out to me. Been meaning to get you back on the show, and this was the perfect time to do it. So we'll hash out another 3 or 6 month period here and crank you back on, particularly after Carb Backloading Part 2 is out and folks want to hear about that.
Yeah. That'd be great. And like any opportunity to talk to you, whether recorded or not, I will jump on.
Awesome, man. Well, Kiefer, it's great having you on again. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Ditto. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.